Thanks to the worship team this morning for being faithful. And I'm grateful for our pastors and the way you host worship and create a space where we encounter God together. We're really fortunate to have so many gifted ministers here. For those of you who don't know me, my name's Colin, and I'm a really lousy member of this church. I rarely show up for things. I haven't been in a small group for years. Haven't been in a committee in like 15 years. Not made any casseroles for any sick people. Really terrible. And I think that the reason the elders put up with me on the membership list is because I'm married to Janine, probably. So I blame being gone a lot as my reason. My work for the last 15 years has taken me away a good bit, especially the last 7 when we've lived in Indiana. During those 7 years, I spent a lot of my time wandering around the world, hanging out with Quakers in various places, including in East Africa, where Sean and Katrina, some other members of our meeting, now serve. And so I spent a lot of time there. My first trip there was in 2011, just before I started working for Friends United Meeting, and I was invited to speak at a week-long pastors' gathering for 1,000 Quaker pastors. Sometimes we think about Friends and we think about the guy in the oatmeal box, or we look in the mirror and think, that's what Quakers look like. But the fact is that the face of Quakerism in the 21st century is a young woman who lives in a very rural part of East Africa, or maybe looks like the people that Hal and Nancy have worked with in South America. It's not us. There's the changing face of Quakerism that we need to be paying attention to. But for the first time I was there, my son Sam went with me. And at the end of our time, we traveled around for about 2 weeks, and then at the end of our trip, we decided to take a day-long raft trip down the headwaters of the Nile. Now, I love rafting, and this trip was especially fun. There are about a half dozen Class 5 rapids on this stretch of river, and a few that were even worse. We came to one, and the guide said, this is called the Dead Dutchman. And we got to it, and he said, we're going to portage around this. And somebody in the raft said, why are we getting out? And he said, because we don't want to rename it the Dead Americans. And so I'm going to try to control this from here. So it started out just so nice and easy and beautiful, kind of like paddling down the Willamette, right? Except for the exotic birds and the hyenas and the hippos and the crocodiles that were sitting on the bank. If you're paddling down the Willamette, you might see a two-headed fish, but you don't usually see hippos and crocodiles. But it was nice and easy. Then things started to get a little bit nice and rough. Just, you know, it was more exciting. We had to hang on a little bit. Later on, it became, oops, let me go back one. Later on, it became a little bit more turbulent at that point, really trying to hang on. And it doesn't want to work from here. There we go. And then it became really kind of rough at that point. And then it sort of became out of control until we reached a point that looked like this a lot. We did that over and over again. Now, whitewater rafting, and these 5 pictures especially, have become for me sort of a visual metaphor for my life. Right? That sort of progression reminds me a lot of parenting, for instance, or my work as a pastor, or being involved with Quaker leadership. It all starts out so nice and easy, and then winds up feeling a lot like that. Does that feel familiar to any of you? It sure does to me. You just want to enjoy the ride, watch the scenery, but you always are feeling like you're thrown from the raft and kind of searching for air. So the first time that I was thrown into the water, it was in the middle of these really strong rapids, and I was underwater, and my eyes opened up, and it seemed like I was down there for an inordinately long time. There was a boulder over here, and there was one over there, and there were bubbles swirling all around, and I'm just staying there under the water, even though I had a life jacket on. I was there long enough that I actually thought, I hope I don't drown here. And something about that thought sort of kicked me into gear, and I began kicking my feet and moving my arms and moving toward the light that was over my head. And Suddenly, I was on the surface of the water. So, spoiler alert, I didn't drown, in fact. And, in fact, made it back to the raft where everybody else was starting to gather. And we worked together to get back in the boat and head down the river to where we were going. So I was asked to talk about hope this morning, and especially as it relates to our life together as a community of faith. And hope's actually one of my favorite topics. I think it's integral to our experience as Christians, and it's especially compelling message to me in a time where lots of people are talking about how we have a crisis of hopelessness, not only in our place and in our time, but in lots of places around the world. People feel this profound sense of hopelessness, and it's especially acute among young people. Sometimes I hear folks talk about the challenges that come from life and that this time in history is worse than others, maybe more hopeless than others, but I actually tend to believe that every moment in time brings its own challenges and struggles to remain hopeful. The intensity level may fluctuate, but there's always some present difficulty. What may be distinct in our time that a lot of people have recognized is the speed of change. That stuff just happens so fast. It comes at us, whether it's changes or so-called advancements in technology or the way political systems are changing in other places or business or even ethics. It just is coming at us in waves. Sometimes so fast, along with this pressure to embrace changes. You have to embrace each and every change, right? You can't fall behind, whether or not we've actually had time to consider that whether or not this is a good change, or to think through the consequences of what happens with this change. Well, all of that pressure can feel overwhelming sometimes to people and creates this sense of hopelessness. So a few years ago, many years ago now, military strategists came up with an acronym to talk about this reality. It's called VUCA, of being volatile and uncertain and complex and ambiguous. And other disciplines have taken this up as well, and thinking about the rapid nature of change and how you can't plan any longer like we used to, that the times are just always shifting. And the sense that we're always feeling like we're being thrown out of the raft without a lot of stability. And it creates this sense in some people of just feeling outraged by it. There have been some recent studies by social psychologists who look at social media and have said the number one emotion expressed in social media is what? It's outrage. People feel cynical and fearful and depressed. This morning, as we were praying for worship today, we were talking about this sort of general feeling sometimes of feeling hopeless because we want so badly to change stuff. We want to make a difference. We want to fix the world, especially those of us in this sort of social justice tradition. We feel like that's our calling by God. We've got to fix it, and we've got to fix it now. And so we're always searching for some dramatic action that's going to change everything. And in fact, the world doesn't work like that. Or we look for some sort of political strongman or woman who makes a big promise to come in and fix everything, going to make it great again, vote for me. And we put our hope in that person and it doesn't work out. Now, hope can be a really confusing thing. To hope in something is not the same thing as having hopes. A hope might be like, boy, I hope he stops talking soon. You know, that's a hope. Or, boy, I hope my favorite team wins today. Those are hopes that are kind of like wishes. But a hope, to hope in something, is different than that. It's more of an action. It's to move toward an envisioned reality, kind of like we sang in the songs this morning. Theologically, we sometimes talk about hope as an idea or a feeling, when it really is an action. We talk about faith in the same way, like it's a thing rather than a verb, an action. From the perspective of the Bible, hope is an active trust or an expectant sense of confidence that arises out of our experience of God and God's promised future. So I find hope as I meet up face to face with God and I see that place that I'm feeling called into. Hope isn't like losing your set of car keys. You just can't find them. Rather, I think from a theological perspective, hope is always just out in front of us beyond our arm's length. And we always rediscover hope. We always find it. We experience it again when we step into it. And there it is. There's hope again. And the nature of God and the nature of hope is to always move us forward. And so it's always just beyond our reach. And we only continue to find hope as we keep moving. So it's a mystery that draws us, it calls to us, and is waiting to meet us, but as I said, only as we keep moving forward. Does that make sense? So the question in the context of the faith community is, how do we continue to act in hope, especially in those moments when we feel like our raft's about to tip over, or we're afraid that we're not going to make it? So let's consider a story from Acts 27. It's a story where the Apostle Paul and others get caught in a really severe storm and their boat's about to sink. And in fact, at the end of the story, it does sink. And I was drawn to this story a while back. I was reading a book by Rufus Jones, who's one of those old famous Quakers. And in a little couple paragraphs in his book, he talks about this story, and he in the story, as we'll read it, you see that they drop four anchors. And he likens these four anchors to four ideas that emerge from the text. And so I'm expanding on that idea this morning, and I just found it kind of helpful thing. So here's the text. When it was decided that we would sail for Italy, Paul and some other prisoners were handed over to a centurion named Julius, who belonged to the Imperial Regiment. We boarded a ship about to sail for ports along the coast to the province of Asia, and we put out to sea. The next day we landed in Sidon, and Julius, in kindness to Paul, allowed him to go to his friends so that they might provide for his needs. From there we put out to sea again, but the winds were against us. Those darn winds sometimes are against us. When we had sailed across the open sea off the coast of Cilicia and landed at Myra, there the centurion found another ship sailing for Italy and put us on board. We made slow headway as the wind did not allow us to hold our course. We moved along the coast with difficulty and came to a place called Fair Havens. Oops. Winter was approaching and sailing was dangerous, so Paul warned them, "Our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to ship and cargo and to our own lives also." But the centurion pilot and owner of the ship ignored Paul's warnings. When a gentle south wind began to blow, we saw our opportunity and we weighed anchor. Before long, a wind of hurricane force swept down upon us, so we gave way to it and were driven along. We were hardly able to secure the lifeboat. We passed ropes under the ship itself to hold it together. Imagine that. We got to tie this sucker together. We took such a violent battering from the storm that we threw the cargo overboard, and on the third day threw the ship's tackle overboard as well. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and the storm continued raging, we were ready to give up all hope. Paul stood up before them and said, "I urge you to keep your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Will the ship be destroyed? Last night an angel of the God to whom I belong and to whom I serve stood beside me and said, 'Do not be afraid. You must stand trial before Caesar, and God has graciously given you the lives of all who will sail with you. So keep up your courage, for I believe in God that it will happen.' And on the 14th night, we were still being driven across the sea when about midnight the sailors sensed that they were approaching land. Fearing we'd be dashed against the rocks, we dropped four anchors and prayed for daylight." I'm going to go back. So the story is that Paul's on a journey that he didn't plan or desire. He was imprisoned. He wasn't going to a place of his choosing. It was completely out of his control. Sometimes our lives are out of control for a couple of reasons. Something like this happens. Or we give up control, we give it to God, and we're led in places that we didn't expect. But this is one of those negative places. And they're doing everything they can to kind of hold their life together. They throw stuff overboard. All of the normal tactics that they would try to save themselves weren't working. And they were heading for rocks. They were feared they were going to be destroyed and lose their lives. And so they dropped four anchors that they hoped would hold them through the darkest of night until the morning when they heard Paul's message that somehow God would appear and God would save them. Now I want to look at these four anchors. I want to think about the text and as these are the four anchors that sort of emerge for Rufus Jones anyway. And they're not the only four anchors that we could talk about. I'm not trying to suggest these are the things you have to do in order to find hope. But they're four interesting anchors, I think, especially as we think about community. The first one is, I believe God. I believe God. Sometimes we spend time thinking about and trying to teach people what to believe about God, which is actually a useful thing, I think, that we do actually have things that we believe about God. Now that I've worked my way out of every job in the Quaker world, I'm working for the Mennonites, and we're having a discussion around Anabaptist theology because we're working on a project together. And I don't remember how the conversation went, but somebody in the group said, well, it's easy for Colin. He's a Quaker, and they don't believe in anything. That's actually a misnomer. We actually do believe in lots of stuff. And one of our weaknesses is that we don't actually help bring people into the faith very well. We don't have a good process for teaching and encouraging and inviting people into this life we've come to know at the depths of our being and this God we know. It's really, really important. Orthodoxy matters, not because there's a test at the end, but because it shapes the course of our lives. It helps us to live in orthopraxy, that is, in a right way in the world by knowing what's right and true and good. But that's not actually what he's talking about here. He's talking about belief in God as an experience, to come to actually trust God. It's not the ideas about God. It's about believing God. Not in a second-hand sort of way. One of the songs we sang this morning talked about being taken out to deep water, right? Think about the story of Jesus out on the lake where he tells Peter to go out into deep water. And you have all these people gathered on the shore. Well, the shore is a really safe place. It's a nice place to listen. But obedience happens out in the deep water where you're in over your head, where you're no longer in control. On the shore, all you can hear is somebody else's idea about what happened out there. It's only when you go out into that deep place that you actually experience it for yourself. That's what trust is all about. For friends, early on, they talked about becoming unshakable in our foundation. These solid women and men of God who had become firm and secure and strong in their faith. How? Because they had spent adequate time in the presence of God. That was the whole focus, to spend time in the presence of God. One way to define belief is to behold that which we hold dear. To believe in something is to behold that which we hold dear. So my question to you this morning is, what do you behold? What do you spend your time focused on? I mean, I sure see a lot of people focused on lots and lots of other things. And we're so wired in to our phones, for instance, that is that the voice that helps us understand what reality is? Is it CNN who or Fox News or whatever your flavor or news flavor of choice is? Is that what defines our world? Or is it, in fact, the God who continues to speak to us? So as a community, how are we working together to strengthen our belief? Yes, Lord, I'll hurry. The second is, I belong to God. I belong to God. Unreservedly. Checking my time here, actually. I'll hurry. So I belong to God. So one of the places that I spent some time was in Nepal. and there, to become a Christian, it's a serious issue. You'll notice we don't have a baptismal font here. It's not because we don't believe in baptism. We actually believe that baptism is really, really important. And so we would say it's actually essential. In Nepal, Quakers actually are baptized with water. Why? Because for them, you become a Christian, you become a Quaker at the cost of your life. You may lose your family, you may lose your job, you may lose the support of everyone around you. So they do this big public thing where the community comes around them and they baptize people in public. And in that baptism, there is this image of I'm being radically identified with Christ. I belong to this God and to this community. And it's very, very powerful. It makes complete sense in that culture. And for us, we sometimes don't even want to be labeled as a Christian. It's uncomfortable, and there's all this baggage attached to it. And there, they take it on with this great sense of hope because it's changing their whole life. So how, as a community, are we encouraging a sense of belonging to God? I serve God is the third one. In the New Testament, that you see the disciples vacillating between being fearful to act and rushing ahead of Jesus, having this anxiety to do something meaningful. It's the same anxiety we feel in our day. Of we feel like we are in this place where we want to serve God. And yet the call of Jesus is a very simple one. It's just follow me. Follow me. Walk with me. Engage in the things that I've called you to do. And so how are we doing that as a community? How are we helping one another be faithful to the life we're given, faithful to the place that we are serving, recognizing that it's not our job. We can't change the world on our own, but we can impact the world around us in meaningful, eternal, transformative ways. And then lastly, who is the God who's given me those who sail with me? The people that God has given to sail with me. Often when we come to church, we think about how is this community of people helping me? What are they doing for me? But this is, in fact, turns this on its head and said, how am I strengthening and supporting? How am I investing my life in the lives of other people so that they might be hopeful? Who are the ones that I'm responsible to help impact their lives and lift them up? In 1 Corinthians 10, it says, God will not give us any more than we can handle and bear. As Americans, we read that very individualistically. God won't give me anything more than I can bear. And yet, I meet people all the time who, they're so overwhelmed by the world and circumstances that they face. The reality of that text is it's not written to individuals. It's written to community. The you in that text, in every place, is community. I will not give you as a community anything more than you can bear. And so the responsibility and the opportunity is for those of us to come around the person who's just been hit by that wave and is thrown under the water to help bring them up and carry them and support them when they can't do it on their own. There's hope there. So the story ends. They survive the night. They let loose the four anchors. They run the ship aground. And they swim to the shore of Malta, an island. There's a whole other sermon about being an island of hope to a world that needs it as a community, but we won't go there today. So as we go into open worship and into the silence, where the voice of God is often the thing that stills the storms that are outside of us and the ones within us, I encourage you to think about those four anchors and those three questions. May the living Christ speak to us this morning.